You've probably heard all the end-of-year headlines about gun violence in Chicago.
Chicago has been hit with a major spike in gun violence.
More than 700 people were murdered. Over 4,000 shot.
What is going on in Chicago that it's had more murders and shootings than the two largest cities in the U.S. combined, New York and Los Angeles?
Today on the 21st, we go beyond those headlines to ask, why are so many being killed not just in Chicago, but throughout the Midwest? What will it take to stop the violence? We'll speak with a criminologist, a WBEZ Chicago reporter, and hear from one Chicago mom who asked a jury to be lenient in sentencing a man who killed her son. And we'll check in with other communities like Peoria. Here's Mayor Jim Artis on how that city's working to build trust between the police and its residents.
There's not an easy fix. I mean, trust has to be earned, and it takes a lot of time.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 2016 was a violent year for Illinois. In Chicago, there were more than 700 homicides. That's more than any major U.S. city. But it is important to point out, when you look at the homicide rate, cities like Detroit and St. Louis have much, much more violence and death than Chicago. But Chicago has been grabbing headlines this year because of how much the deaths and numbers have increased last year. We want to go deeper into this issue today and explain more than just the numbers and the headlines you're seeing, whether that's on 60 Minutes or in the Chicago Tribune. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with a Chicago-based reporter who's been covering this. We're going to speak to a criminologist who studied why the Midwest is more violent than other parts of the country. Later on in the show, we're also going to be looking at other communities. We're going to be going to Peoria and Danville that have also been affected by gun violence, learn about their efforts to stop the shootings. If you want to share your thoughts on this, our call-in number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. But first, we wanted to start this conversation with Lisa Daniels. She's the mother of Darren Easterling, who was shot and killed in 2012 when he was just 25. And she joins us now to share his story and what the past 4 years have been like for her since she lost her son. Lisa, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for joining us. And let me start by saying I'm so sorry for your loss. We appreciate you being with us to share your story today.
I appreciate you taking the opportunity to hear Darren's experience, and I thank you guys for having me. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Lisa, I know it's a tough question to ask what the past 4 years have been like for you. I imagine you've been on a very long journey over the past couple of years.
I would call it that. I would definitely call it a journey, Nyla, more so than anything, a journey of personal growth, a journey of gaining clarity, a journey of learning about the truth of unconditional love, and more importantly, learning about the truth of what forgiveness looks like. I've also spent time planning the future for my grandchildren. My son had two children. They are now ages 7 and 9. They are a girl and boy, respectively. And growing in myself, again, personal growth, trying to find out or discover what was I supposed to do with this. My son died, and he died as a result of a violent lifestyle. He died as a result of personal choices, and all of those things probably speak to a lot of the circumstances that we're seeing as it relates to the violence in the city of Chicago these days, in fact, across the country. But my journey for me was, what am I supposed to do with this? And that is where I've landed, where I did land in 2016, when I finally came to an understanding about some of the things that I thought would benefit others as the result of Darren's passing, how others could benefit, how others could have a different experience as a result of his experience. And so that's where I landed in 2016.
Lisa, you know, you said that your son Darren was killed because of the lifestyle that he was in. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Was it something you worried about, that he would be shot?
Did I worry? No, I did not worry. My faith always gave me the comfort that I needed. And it was truly my faith that got me through, that gave me the peace that I needed to accept the outcome when it did happen. And none of that changes how much I miss my son, how much I wish he was still here, how much I wish he had made different decisions. But it was truly my faith that enabled me to accept the outcome of his experience, and to get, again, to begin to look within and say, okay, what am I supposed to do with this now? Where do we go from here? Where do Darren and I go from here?
So it sounds like you blamed yourself in a way for his passing.
No. I didn't hear that at all. I'm not sure how you heard that. I didn't blame myself at all. I did the best that I could.
Good. Thanks for clarifying.
I gave Darren all the tools that he needed to be everything that he could have possibly been in his life. His decisions were his own. And I could not take any responsibility. I would have been a disservice to myself and to his grandchildren and to anybody who I come in contact with for me to feel as though I needed to take responsibility for my son's choices.
Thanks for clarifying. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Now, you said your faith. I wonder how much your faith also played a role, because you said that you did something in October at the trial for the man who was convicted of killing your son. You asked the jury not to give him a harsh sentence. Why did you think it was important to go to the jury at his sentencing for the man who was convicted of killing your son and say that he shouldn't be given a harsh sentence?
Because we had nothing to gain by him having a harsh sentence. He was looking at a potential, because he took a plea and the offer was 15 years. So he was looking at a maximum of 15 years. Before he took the plea, he was looking at a maximum of 45 years. And that young man is 25, I think, now. I think he's 26 years old. And for him to spend the next 45 years in jail or the next 15 years in jail does the world no service. He didn't have a criminal record before he went in jail. And I don't believe for one second that he woke up that morning, that Sunday morning, July 22nd, on 2012, and said that I'm going to go kill somebody. He made a mistake, just like my son made a mistake, and it was unfortunate. And when I say mistake, I don't take lightly the decisions that he made. But what I mean when I say mistake, I mean that he made a mistake in the way that he chose to live his life. And I believe that this young man did the same thing. And if it had been the other way around, and it were my son fighting for his life, and having made the decisions, made all the poor decisions that he made, I would want somebody to speak up for him. And so this was one of those things where when I asked myself, what am I supposed to do with this? What am I supposed to do with this situation that I've been handed? That was one of the things that I was supposed to do. I was supposed to fight for somebody else's life, and that's what I did. I don't believe that any of us should be defined by our worst mistake. And that goes for my son, and it also goes for this young man too. I could have been labeled a hypocrite to say that my son's legacy should not have been defined by his worst mistake, but this young man should. No, I don't think so. So it was important for me to speak up on his behalf, because I would have wanted the same for mine. And again, for him to spend the next 15, 20 years in jail does nothing to change the atmosphere, does nothing to wake up the gifts that probably lie dormant in this young man. It does nothing to add to society. It only makes individuals angrier, and then they're released, and then they're not equipped. They don't have the tools to reenter into society, and they are of no service. So I think that it was important for him to have an opportunity to be rehabilitated and to come out and to reenter a different person, and that's my hope and my prayer for him.
Lisa, one last question for you. I know you're starting an organization in Chicago in your son's honor that aims to help support family members of victims of gun violence. I know this is something now obviously, that is such an important issue for you. And I want to ask, both with your work with that group, you know, where do you see the path forward for communities affected by violence, for Chicago, for your neighborhood, for other neighborhoods that are dealing with this?
I see when we have platforms like the one that you're offering today and other platforms similar in nature where we are learning to share the stories, we are listening to the stories behind the stories because it doesn't serve society. It doesn't serve us to continue to blame and to view individuals that commit these crimes as monsters and not worthy of being in society. It serves us to understand that they are human beings just like we are and that we all have a story to tell, that we're all coming from a particular place, that we're all recovering from something, and we all manifest our hurts and our pains and our trials and our experiences differently. And if we could become a society again where we understand that we're all connected by our humanity and that we can't be human by ourselves, then we will begin to, I believe, we'll begin to heal and we can begin to curb this experience that we're having right now. And that's what the organization, the Darren B. Easterling Center for Restorative Practices, is set to do. We are set to aid individuals, families, children, and individuals just like my son who have committed violent crimes to heal from trauma that they've experienced at any point in their lives and to obliterate this cycle of violence that continues in our society.
Lisa Daniels, as you're just hearing, is starting that foundation. She's the mother of Darren Easterling. Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you again for having me.
As Lisa said, we want to talk about these stories today. We want to understand more about these connections. I've got two folks here now to help us do that a little bit more. Patrick Smith is a reporter for WBEZ. He's on the line from there in Chicago. We're also joined by John Hagedorn. He's a professor of criminology, law, and justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Patrick, John, thanks for being with me here on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Patrick, can I start with you? You've been reporting on this at BEZ for quite some time, and I wanted to ask you about the most recent story you did, which was about children who often get caught in the crossfire. And you did a story, folks might have heard it airing this week. Some of the people you spoke with were grandparents of a six-year-old girl, Takara Morgan. She was shot at their West Englewood home last summer. WBEZ did a review of police data and found that in 2016, 41 children younger than 14 were wounded or killed. And that's the largest number of shootings, including children, in the past decade. And I wanted to ask you about what you've been hearing from these families, that you've been talking to who have been affected by this kind of violence.
Well, I'm hearing despair. I'm hearing fear. I'm hearing a sense of abandonment from them. As you mentioned, you know, there were 41 shootings last year in which a child 13 or younger was wounded. That's almost the same as the last 3 years combined. It's just a staggering number.
Wow.
And it leaves people, the family members that I talk to and the community members I talk to, leave them feeling in some ways like no one is safe. Takara, who you mentioned, the six-year-old girl, she was shot in the stomach. Physically, she's okay. She has a scar and she will forever, but she's not going to have any permanent physical damage from that, which is a blessing. But she does have mental anguish from this. She's suspicious of cars that pass by. She's afraid of loud noises. She can't be a sort of happy-go-lucky kid. And her grandparents and her mother are really much the same way. You know, her mother has high blood pressure now. She wants to move. Her grandma's afraid to go outside and walk because there's so much shooting. And they have a sense that just because you're not involved in the conflicts that are leading to all the shootings doesn't mean you won't get caught in the crossfire, and maybe the people who are doing the shooting aren't that concerned that they might catch an innocent victim.
And Patrick, you mentioned something. You said that number was more than the past 3 years combined. And when we see the numbers in headlines, we've seen, of course, all of the national news headlines about this, more than 700 homicides in Chicago in 2016. How does that number compare to previous years?
Yeah, and I just want to say it's not more, it's almost the same.
There
was 43 in the 3 years combined and 41 last year. Either way, just...
Okay, so a difference of two. Thanks for making that.
Yeah, but comparison, you know, we had, according to police, we had 762 murders last year. That's almost 300 more than we had in 2015. I mean, the last time we Chicago had more than 750 murders was way back in 1997. Back then, murders were on the decline, and you can actually read Chicago Tribune articles from the time talking about what great news it is that we finally got under 800 murders. But we haven't been to this sort of dark place in 20 years. You know, last year we had 468. This year we had 762. It's just a huge difference.
Patrick, we just have about a minute before break. Let me ask you quickly, as we start to get it, we're going to take a break and we'll get into more of these issues in a minute. But what's been the response from Mayor Emanuel? I mean, obviously, there's been sort of national headlines. President-elect Trump has been making comments about this. What's sort of the internal conversation in Chicago right now about sort of this end of the year tally from the city itself?
Well, you know, Mayor Emanuel gave a sort of violence address a little while ago, where he announced that they were planning to hire almost 1,000 new officers, and he said they were going to put more into mentoring in the communities that are most affected by violence. Those are sort of the two big pushes for Mayor Emanuel: more cops and more mentoring. I also am hearing from a lot of people that they need more economic investment. I know that that's something that John Hagedorn has studied, this idea that the lack of opportunity or the lack of hope is part of the reason that young men really are doing so much shooting. And that's something that I'm hearing from people in the communities, that they want more jobs, they want more opportunity. Mayor Emanuel is, you know, I think he's heard that and is trying to address it. I don't know how successful he's been so far.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk to John more about that and continue this conversation with Patrick Smith from WBEZ in Chicago. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Illinois' violent 2016. The numbers, more than 700 homicides in Chicago in 2016, more than any other major U.S. city, as you probably heard from the headlines. We do want to point out the context of that. When you look at the homicide rate, cities like Detroit and St. Louis are have much more violence and death than Chicago. To explain a little bit more about this, we've been talking to Patrick Smith. He's at WBEZ in Chicago. He's been covering that. John Hagedorn is with us as well. He's a criminologist. He teaches criminology, law, and justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Patrick, one last question for you, just about talking about the mayor's initiatives about economic investment, getting to some of the systemic problems. I wanted to ask you just a quick question about Illinois' gun laws, because they're among the strictest in the Midwest. Chicago certainly has that. Are anti-gun violence activists, are they pushing for stricter gun laws? What are you seeing in sort of the conversation in Chicago about how to solve this? Is it more of a, we need to deal with systemic issues like mentoring and economic investment in neighborhoods? Are you seeing an anti-gun law conversation as well?
You know, it's not a big part of the conversation. I think the biggest part of it, as you're talking about, is the systemic issue. But if people are talking about gun laws, they talk about Indiana's gun laws. You know, I think you'll hear from anti-gun violence activists and from the mayor and the police chief that many of the illegal guns they recover are purchased in Indiana, which has much more lax gun laws than here in Illinois. And you hear activists in Chicago and in Illinois talking about trying to make those laws tougher in Indiana, or trying to make federal laws tougher so that it would cut down on the sort of illegal guns that are getting into the city.
Mm-hmm. Patrick Smith from WBEZ. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
I want to go to John Hagedorn now. John, you know, as we're talking about, you've studied this issue. You know, around sort of, as before we get to the systemic issues, I just want to ask you about the numbers. We look at more homicide deaths in Chicago, more than New York and L.A. combined, even though those cities have higher populations. What do you think is behind just, let's just talk about the Chicago numbers before we get to other Midwestern cities.
Sure. First, I want to express my admiration for Lisa Daniels. Her sort of stance of humanity at the sentencing of the young man who killed her son is just really remarkable and admirable. And it's sort of confronting a system that is more about punishment and revenge than justice. And we need more of Lisa Daniels' attitude in this if we're going to interrupt the cycle of violence. So the numbers are Chicago's homicide rate in the 90s, early 90s, was the same as New York and Los Angeles's. And what happened in the 90s is that New York and Los Angeles start to drop very rapidly, while Chicago's did not. And then in the 2000s, it was steady and then started to jump in the last 2 years. And so what we have is Midwest, Memphis and Cleveland and Chicago have similar homicide rates, Milwaukee as Chicago, and Chicago is still well under Detroit and St. Louis. And so what you look at, and there's nothing scientific, I can't prove one thing or the other, but there's some really suggestive data that the experience of Black people in the Midwest, of the Rust Belt cities, of having some promise and having hope there that the industrial economy was going to bring some sort of better life, has been dashed. And so when you have numbers like in Chicago of young people aged 18 to 24 have a 59% unemployment rate, according to a study by the Great Cities Institute where I work, you see the nature of despair. And in Chicago, particularly, you have not only unemployment, because you're poor doesn't mean you're violent, but added to that has been the instability of communities, the destruction of the projects which scattered people across the city, Black people, and the projects were 99% Black. You have communities that are unstable, schools that close, that move kids again. You have a sense that there's nothing we can do, and you get that feeling of despair, you know, throughout Englewood and Lawndale, the two areas of highest homicide in Chicago.
And when we think about that, John, you mentioned the school closings. I have to think it's been 2 years. It's been about 2 years, right, since Mayor Emanuel's school closing policy. Is it too much of a jump to think about when you're talking about instability, school closings? There were a lot of questions in Chicago at the time about what effect that would have on neighborhoods. How much do you think that may have contributed to what we saw over the past year in Chicago with the city and homicide rates?
Well, it interacts with the gang situation, and that's what I've been studying for the last, 20 years in Chicago, is that the gangs, the African-American gangs, shattered over the end of the 90s. The large super gangs that controlled everything were broken up, and largely a response to the horrific rates of violence in the 90s, but also the tearing down of the projects moved people into different neighborhoods. And so the gangs, instead of being large, strong gangs with leadership and all that, were neighborhood cliques. And so the result has been a lot of local hostilities. The violence we have today is unlike the 90s, where there were gangs doing citywide wars. The violence today is local, it's spontaneous, it's angry, it's more youthful. And the school closings just contribute to the lack of stability within Black communities. And we're talking, this isn't a gang problem per se. There are as many Latino gang members as Black gang members, but three quarters of all homicide victims and offenders are African American. So we're not looking at gangs as much as we're looking at race. What's happened to the Black community? And what's happened to the Black community has been a picture of devastation, of unemployment, of despair and instability. And those things we know from the UN study of homicide, those are the issues that correlate with high rates of violence.
I'm speaking with John Hagedorn. He's a professor of criminology, law, and justice at the University of Illinois in Chicago. We're talking about violence, not just in Chicago, but across Illinois and the Midwest. And I wanted to bring in someone else into this conversation. I want to go to Danville. here in Central Illinois, because there's a community activist who his name is Nate Bobo Smalls. He's with the Three Kings of Peace. He's on the line with us from Danville. This group has been rallying people together to combat the violence that they've seen in their community. Bobo, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, as we're listening to John talk about these spontaneous sort of outbursts of violence in Chicago, the things that he studied across the Midwest, I wonder the work that you all are doing with Three Kings of Peace in Danville, when you think about the incidents of gun violence that you saw last year, are they a reflection of what John's saying? Are they sort of these like spontaneous fights and these outbreaks? Is that what you're also seeing in Danville?
Well, a lot of that is right in what he said. But most of the thing that that I know for myself, because, you know, I travel around the country sometimes speaking, you know, because I'm in the Negro League Baseball Hall of Fame, so I go around the country speaking to kids about making the right choices. And what I see, because I'm the commissioner of Danville Recreation Basketball League, so all the kids, all the gang members, all the innocent kids flock to one specific place, and that's Garfield Park. So I see all the violence. I know all the kids, the gangbangers, some good kids, some bad kids. And what I've come to realize is most of these kids, even in Chicago and around the country, most of these kids that you see in these gangs, toting guns and killing up one another, you know, young men just killing up one another, shooting one another, people scared to come at their houses because they're afraid of drive-bys. Most of these kids, I try to study them just like I studied for a test. And most of the things that I see now, and I've been seeing for a long time, most of these kids that you see that commit these violence, they're really trying to be a part of something. But they're trying to be a part of something the wrong way. Mm. And they feel like if they got a gun, it's a point that they got to prove. And
well, yeah, and when you say that, I can't help but think about the incident last summer, a 16-year-old boy. In fact, I was in Danville. I think it was the morning, or it was right after that shooting that happened. He was shot at a basketball court in Garfield Park. He was caught in the crossfire. When you say that, as you think about how these things are happening, I want to ask what you guys are doing with Three Kings of Peace. How are you working? How did that incident in particular, how did you all work after that to try to help resolve this?
Well, in that incident, the young man who got killed, his name was Devon. He was a basketball player, good kid. Good kid. I mean, when I say a good kid, he was a good kid. He wasn't no trouble at all. We had played basketball that night, you know, because we played from Monday through Thursday. So, and we got through playing around 10:30, and I closed the park up and everything. Everybody went home. But it was about five or six boys left that they just wanted to play around because they were waiting on their mothers to come pick them up. So as they was waiting for their mother to come pick them up, these two gangs got into a crossfire. They were shooting back and forth across the park. And this little boy, mother who came to pick him up, she had the van waiting. She was motioning for him to come to the van. And what he did was he didn't know, you know, what was going on really. And he ran right into the crossfire of what was going on, and that's how he got killed. And as I was home, I guess I've been home for about 15 to 20 minutes, they called me and told me, said, it was a shooting at Garfield Park. So I said, well, I got to go over there and see what's happening. And as I got over there, they had the detectives and the police department and everybody over there, and they took the young man to Champaign, which a while, you know, he didn't live. But his death sparked a lot of things in Danville. It made a lot of people start really paying attention to the violence we was having, as far as the guns and as far as the violence that we was having. People was paying attention, but this really caught the town by surprise. And everybody kind of rallied around what happened to this young man. And it changed a whole lot of things. It really did.
It did. And I wonder if you could tell us, I know that you and a local pastor reached out to the president of NAACP in Danville, Ed Butler. You asked what you could do to help stop the violence. What are you all doing now?
Okay, me and Edward Butler, who's the president here in Danville for NAACP, and Pastor Frankie McCullough, who's the president of Pastor Alliance, and me, Bobo Smalls, commissioner of the Recreation Basketball League. And what we're trying to do is the kids that we know, we're trying to get to them to find out, you know, all the beefing and stuff they're doing, all the texting they're doing on the phones and showing you the guns and showing you what they could do to you. We're really trying to find out, you know, what's the reason for it. And I guess sometimes a lot of people really don't want to talk about it. Sometimes, you know, people are afraid. You know, you got people that are afraid just to step out. We've been marching all summer, marching against violence, marching against crime. Whatever that was going on in our city, we was trying to get it back. And we had a few people marching with us, but the thing about when you're trying to put yourself out on that firing line, it's a different story.
Mm.
You know, you could always stand back in the pulpit and say certain things, and in the schools you could say certain things, but when you come out of the school and come out of the pulpit and hit the street and start marching, that's when you can really tell, you know, where's your faith, where's your courage at. And the three kings, out of all the things that we try to do, we try to make sure that we try to find out what the reason that these kids getting shot up so much.
Mm.
What's the reason that they just beefing for no reason at all? For no reason at all. Maybe because they don't like one another. Maybe because a guy look at them the wrong way. It's not about, and the thing about it, and the thing about the situation here in Danville with all the killings we done had and all the drive-bys and all the shootings we done had, it's not about drugs. It's really not about drugs. It's about just simple things like, well, I'm from Chicago. We don't like Danville. Danville don't like us. So mm.
So are they people from Chicago? So people are coming down from Chicago? People who move from Chicago? Is it both?
Yeah. Well, see, when they tore all the projects and stuff down in Chicago, they had to start busing people out to certain areas in Illinois, and they bust out a lot of them here. Came to the projects, you know, Fair Oaks, Green Meadow, and different places where, you know, these people had to start living. But see, one thing about when people have been uprooted from where they lived all their lives, you know, it's a hard transition sometimes. And then you got these young kids feel like they got a point to prove. Well, we're going to move here to Danville, and we're going to show you what Chicago all about. And Danville kids going to say, no, you're not going to come to Danville and show us what it's all about, because this is our town. So now they're back and forth over little silly things that really don't make no sense. And you got a lot of innocent kids getting shot. You got a lot of innocent kids getting killed. But see, one thing I found out, I'm from the 60s. I'm back in the era of Martin Luther King. So I know what marching and protesting all about. And what it is, if you don't stand up for something to try to grab these young men aside and talk to them, they're going to continue on doing what they're doing. Us being the three kings, I guess you might call us something like a rat pack.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for – afraid we've got to take a break here, but I want to thank you, Nate Bobo Smalls. As he said, the three kings of peace – what he's doing in Danville. Stay tuned. We're going to continue this conversation about violence across Illinois on the 21st. We'll pick this up in just a minute. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about, as this new year starts, 2016, and the violent year that it's been for Illinois, not just for Chicago, but for other parts of the state. A tweet we just got from Lauren, 60% of Chicago's gun crimes come from out of state. She says, we need a federal background Czech law to close the gun show loophole. If you want to tweet to us, you can do that at 21st Show. We were just hearing about what's happening in Danville, what they've been doing. Let's go to another part of the state, into Peoria. We're joined now by Jim Artis. He's the mayor of Peoria, where he leads a program called Don't Shoot Peoria. He's here to tell us more about that. Mayor Artis, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Nyla. Appreciate the opportunity.
Now, you all rolled out, the Don't Shoot Peoria program was rolled out in 2012. It's based on a national program to prevent gun violence in communities. How have you been implementing this in Peoria?
Well, it's been a it's been kind of a long road to this point, Nyla, but it's something that I believe that the community started to embrace. We really started in 2012 just by trying to educate our citizens just to the growing problem that we're seeing with gun crimes. And you know, this philosophy, if you will, came from David Kennedy, and he spent a career studying and is still studying you know, the impacts of gun crimes in our community. So, you know, we really focused our efforts on gang gun violence, and that is really where our focus has been, is because that's where the majority of these incidents are occurring.
Right, and I was looking actually at the stats that you guys have on your website. For the first half of 2016, I noticed that murder by gunfire, according to the stats on your site, was down by 33%. I did see that shooting incidents were up by 40%. How much are you looking at those numbers right now, and how do you sort of balance those numbers with the strategies that you all are working on a day-to-day basis in communities?
Yeah, that's a great question and a big concern, because as we have seen relatively lower numbers on homicides by gunfire, we are seeing more shots reported. There's really a couple reasons for that. At least here in Peoria, is we instituted a shot spotter technology back in 2013, where we actually have the ability through technology to pick up and record these shots fired. And it's not just, they don't just tell you that a shot was fired. A lot of times they can tell you the caliber, if it was a small caliber handgun or if it was a larger caliber semi-automatic, you know, rifle. They can tell you how many shots were fired. They can tell you the direction of the shots that were fired, if it was in a moving vehicle and so on. But so before 2013, the only barometer that we had to register shots fired in the community was when somebody actually called them in. And so, you know, and now we have actual documented numbers that we know. So we've seen some of those numbers go up, but we have found that in some areas of the city that unfortunately have a gunfire occur more often, some people just don't even call it in. Whereas, they just get used to the sound and they don't call it in. So we weren't really sure that the actual numbers of, well, we know the actual numbers of calls for shots fired were a lot less than what was actually occurring. But with that said, even though we have the technology now and we know the number of shots are fired, we're still seeing increases in those shots fired year over year.
And so part of it sounds like for you is, it sounds like a lot of this program is not just educating the community, but you all getting a handle on the data and then knowing where to apply resources. What other big lessons have you taken from this that you or feel like sort of the most important things, principles you guys are using right now?
Well, you know, a big component of Don't Shoot is the community component. And, you know, we can, you know, you get to those old sayings, you know, you can have a police officer on every street and then every street corner, and it's not going to totally stop crime, and it's not. But the biggest resource that we have are the citizens in our community, and we're really talking to them about how much we rely on them for information, for us to be able to get information back to their neighborhoods and what they're doing, and when a crime does occur, that we have to know about it. You know, a lot of these gun crimes, the majority of these gun crimes, don't happen in a one-on-one scenario. There's other people that are there. There's other witnesses. And there's still a big reluctance in a lot of those communities to come forward and give law enforcement the information they need to stop these things from happening. So for whatever reasons those are, and there's a lot of them in many communities, there's not real good relationships between the police department and some of the neighborhoods that these crimes are happening in. We have to address those so people are comfortable that the information that they give to law enforcement is the right information, that they can take those people off the streets and out of their neighborhoods, and that there won't be retribution back to them for giving them the information. So what we're really trying to group in Peoria, it's called PCAV, Peoria Community Against Violence. And what we're really working very hard on with the state's attorney and the police chief and the sheriff in conjunction with a lot of these neighborhood organizations is really growing PCAV and really trying to empower those neighborhoods to really control their own destiny. And a lot of that is rebuilding the trust and the relationship between law enforcement and their neighborhoods.
Mayor Artis, where would you say that trust is right now between communities and the police in Peoria? Is it where you would like it to be?
No, we need to get a lot better. I think we've come a long way in the last couple years since we started this new don't shoot focus. But we have a long way to go. And whether the relationships are bad or good or somewhere in between, these relationships are still impacted in a large way by what's happening in some of these in Chicago for sure, in Baltimore, in some of these other cities that you're seeing these really negative situations. A lot of times people just kind of they think it's bad everywhere, and it's as bad here as it is in Chicago. So we need to continue to work on those relationships and do what we need to do to help our citizens understand that law enforcement's here to help, and we want every neighborhood to be safe.
Mayor, what would you like to see this year? What specific things are you all hoping to achieve this year to kind of help achieve that trust or help restore that? Especially, it is interesting, as you say, that everyone's looking at news reports of Chicago or Baton Rouge or all of these things that are happening all over the country. It does create a really tough environment.
It does, and we also know that there's not an easy fix. Trust isn't one of those situations where you go into a large room of people that are all concerned about something and say, "Hey, trust me," and it's there. It's earned. Trust has to be earned, and it takes a lot of time. So, we're doing that. Again, it's specific to Peoria. We're really focused on expanding PCAV, expanding the community component of what it's going to take to make our community safer. We have the technology. We have ShotSpotter technology, so we know where the shots are being fired. We're placing a lot of emphasis on the gangs and guns, and we've reduced the gang gun element significantly. But what we really, really need is the power of the people, the power of the neighborhoods to really, take ownership of their neighborhoods back, help the police officers get the information they need to take these bad players out of, not just out of their neighborhoods, but out of our city, put them where they need to be.
Mayor Jim Artis, Mayor of Peoria, telling us a little bit more, updating us on the Don't Shoot Peoria program. Mayor, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome now. Have a nice year.
Thank you.
You bet.
Well, we've gone from Chicago to Danville to Peoria. Let's go back to Chicago and UIC criminologist John Hagedorn. John, as you're listening to all of this, as you heard, as we've heard from so many people, whether it's Lisa Daniels, the mom in Chicago, Bobo Smalls in Danville, now Mayor Artis here in Peoria. My last question for you is just there's so many issues involved with this, as we've talked about systemic. What do you see as the way forward in Illinois? What would you like to see happen this year to help address gun violence?
Wow. I think one of the problems that people want to address is the gun violence. Specifically, is let's figure out who's doing the shooting. Let's identify. Let's get these people off the streets, or let's figure out how to work with people, build youth programs. All those things are important, but we lose sight when we're focusing on the specifics of the larger situation that has created the high levels of violence in Chicago and throughout the Midwest. So what I'd like to see is some sense that we have a catastrophic conditions in the Black community in Chicago, and that this isn't just a matter of trust with the police or concern for community groups. It's really the dedication of the city to rebuild those communities as a whole. You can't have 60% unemployment among youth and think that there's going to be trust and that somehow that everything's going to get better. So I think there's got to be a recognition that there's that the conditions in the Black community in Chicago and other cities, I'm sure, but certainly Chicago, are catastrophic levels and need the kind of Marshall Plan that we did to bail out Europe back in after World War II. We need that kind of all-out effort if we want to reduce violence in Chicago.
But, John, I can't help but think of, when you talk about a Marshall Plan, I think about the resources that were involved in putting into that, and I think about the financial level of cities across this state. You think about this fiscal situation we're in right now with the state. It doesn't seem like create a very optimistic, at least leaves me optimistic about resources being put into these programs. In fact, I wonder if you think the fiscal situation we've been in the past year has created a worse situation for all of these systemic problems.
Yeah, certainly it's been worse, and the resources aren't there. And I think with 8 years of the Obama administration, he didn't pay sufficient attention to the crisis in the cities. There was no real attempt to address the employment crisis in the Midwest. And that with the Trump administration, I don't see how we're going to get anything but more emphasis on law enforcement on one side of the issue. So, no, it's not a very it's a bleak prospect. But I think my job as a social scientist is sort of to tell the truth, is that if you think that just restoring trust is going to solve the homicide rate in Chicago, you're wrong.
Or any other city, for that matter, it sounds like.
Or any other city, or stricter gun laws. You know, I think some attention needs to be paid to why are Midwest rates so much higher than rates of violence on the coast. Is it we have worse police? Is that what it is? I mean, I don't think that the police in Chicago are any less dedicated than those in New York.
So why is the Midwest? Yeah, John, I mean, we have a couple minutes left. I know this is a tough question, but I know this is something you've spent decades studying. Why do you think the Midwest is worse?
Well, I think there's the Black community, the Black populations that migrated into the Midwest to these good jobs in Detroit and Chicago and, you know, and Milwaukee and throughout, that those hopes and aspirations were shattered. And instead of the next generation young people sort of recovering and doing better, they've done worse and worse and worse. So the economies and the politics in the Midwest have been hostile to the Black community. And when you have hostility, it gets repaid. There's a law of the conservation of violence. All violence is repaid. And when you do violence to communities, you're going to get this kind of response. So I think that more attention needs to be paid to the Rust Belt and the experience of Black communities in the Midwest, as opposed to looking at Latinos and, you know, the broader, the gang issues, whatever. What's happened to Black communities? And you know, that if you look at Chicago's history, you can pretty much chart the homicide rate and the ups and downs and what's gone on.
Mm. Thanks for that insight. John Hagedorn is a professor of criminology, law, and justice with the University of Illinois at Chicago. John, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That does it for today. As always, you can follow our conversation online. If you follow 21ST Show, thanks to the folks who tweeted today. We're tweeting out more context and conversation, especially today. Lots of stuff about beyond the headlines of the violent year of 2016 that we've had across Illinois. So follow us there at 21ST Show on our Facebook page. If you search for the 21st to like us there, you can also comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. You can also always find past shows on the NPR One app. If you search for the 21st, we're also available on iTunes and Android. All these links that I'm talking about, if you can't remember anything, just head to our website, 21stshow.org. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about car insurance rates. They've gone up. We'll look at why. Stay tuned for that. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.